Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. With me today is Michael Kester, and we have our first callback show on Double Feature. Actually, this is like our third this year.
Yeah.
But this is, we have really no theme today besides callback, right?
Yeah, pretty much. There's 0% theme and 100% fun.
So one of our most popular episodes has been, what was that movie called?
Big Trouble in Little China.
Big Trouble in Little Sand Beetle, and the Richard Dawkins documentary, which I believe was The Root of All Evil.
Probably was that.
No, you know what? It could be the other one. Enemies of Reason. That's what it was. Enemy, okay. Because it was the pseudoscience thing.
Right.
So we had something going on there. We had
dowsing sand beetles.
We did a crazy as shit John Carpenter movie, and then a movie about crazy shit that Richard Dawkins did. And, you know, it was a fun skeptical
not
angle.
Not crazy shit Richard Dawkins did the film about crazy shit.
Yeah.
It's not the Dawkins college years.
So what are the films that we're doing today?
This episode is Escape from New York and Religulous.
Hey, you figured out how to say Religulous.
I finally did.
Congratulations. I'm glad
practiced
you did that before
night.
We recorded. So just a heads up, we're going to do this shit again next week, right? We have Escape from New York and Religulous this time. And we thought about pairing up both the Escape movies, because there's also Escape from LA. But there's just too much marathoning going on. It's October. We know you're reading top 10 horror lists and marathoning their shit, and you don't have time for our shit. So we just got done with the marathon. We're not going to do that. What we are going to do is we thought, you know what experiment worked out really well was Terminator Prophecy. So, no, it didn't. But what did kind of work, actually, was the Hostel movies. You know, we watched that one week another, and we didn't really care about the pairing. We just did whatever. So, next week, not to force a weird false dichotomy thing, which we wouldn't ever want to impose, but we're going to do... why am I telling people what we're going to do? We'll do that later.
People.
Right now, what we're going to do is Escape from New York. Also, really quick, there's going to be spoilers. You can use the chapters to skip the spoilers. Let's get right into the film. So we're nearing the end of World War III. Crime has risen to 400%, and Manhattan has been turned into a maximum security penitentiary.
The nations only.
This is the world of Battle Royale. I mean Escape from New York. So you've brought me yet another John Carpenter movie.
Yet another.
Maybe one that makes more sense than Big Trouble in Little China.
Possibly.
This is
on the surface, it makes more sense. But once you get deeper down into the sand.
That's what we're all about doing on Double Features, getting deep down into the sand. This is really a podcast for the sand beetles, I think.
Well, this movie came from the 80s. That's where.
Yeah.
And it came from New York. That's when.
Yes.
It's a post-apocalyptic action masterpiece,
right,
as people would have you believe, starring many, many people famous from the era and before.
True.
And it's
by another look at dystopia.
Yeah.
You know, something we looked at when we did the Philip K. Dick stuff, specifically Total Recall, I think. But
yeah.
Scanner Darkly could be looked at as dystopia a bit.
And
we haven't done a whole lot of weird, like, post-apocalypse stuff on this show. We need to do more of that.
It tends to suck.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Yeah, because, I think part of the nature of that is that once you're bringing the, let's call it the flair of the post-apocalypse era, you don't really need to do anything else because people will see your film. They're like, oh, it's really messy in that city because it's 20 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have John Carpenter doing this thing where, so he wrote this film, I guess, in the 70s. He wrote it kind of about Watergate, I guess.
Mm.
And he was shopping it around to the studios, and he failed to explain how this was related to Watergate to any of the studios, so no one picked it up. And then later he did, have you ever heard of Halloween?
Yeah, with the pumpkins.
So he did those films, or at least the first one, and then the studios decided to pick this thing up. Do you see any connections to Watergate here? I mean, is that...
There's a president?
The larger question is John Carpenter just batshit insane, or is there some kind of...
I don't see, that's... Here's...
I just picture a guy running around being like, yeah, you know, Watergate, God.
I'm gonna venture this to you, and this is something that we've never said about a filmmaker.
Oh.
But I think that the thing about John Carpenter that makes him so weird for people like you and I to watch his films,
mm-hmm,
he's painfully normal.
Is that it?
I think that's what it is.
You know, the more we find out about the film industry, it seems the more painfully normal everyone is.
Yeah.
That's kind of sad, like,
I have a feeling that John Carpenter is not crazy, and he is just really normal. Mm. He eats Cheerios for breakfast and goes to bed at 8 p.m. promptly.
Yeah.
Like,
well, not while I was making this film. I mean, they had to shoot during night all the time, so that was
That's true.
It just seems like someone who would make films like this must be a crazy, eccentric guy. Yeah,
or just really normal.
Yeah, I guess
just
that could be
it. Just knows his films, that's what he does.
Well, you know, the Watergate thing to me, I kind of look at it, and I guess I can see this idea of, like, distrust in the government or specifically the president.
They're trying to cover something up. Right. And that was there.
Well, I think the bigger thing, too, is just that the president's kind of a dick. I mean, it's a cynical look at the president, right? It's that Nixon era.
I don't have anything to say about Watergate being the particular time when the president was a dick.
So I should put my Watergate documentaries away and...
Well, the president, you know, the president's been a dick before. He's been a dick since.
So let's talk about something you do have some experience in. Let's talk about cult films.
All right, cult films.
So this would qualify as a cult film.
Dude,
I would suppose,
slap an eye patch on your main character.
Yeah, there's some exploitation for you. So I think cult appeal is something that's really important in films, and people wonder sometimes, like, why we cover that and why that's a thing. And I think beyond just being like a little cute niche that we can, you know, follow,
pander,
pandering, and a lot of it is pandering, you know, hey, whatever, you see cult appeal pop up in a lot of places where it becomes really inspirational for other filmmakers. Escape from New York, you know, I knew Escape from New York just off of the references to Cloverfield comes to mind. You know, you have the infamous poster for Escape from New York with the
Statue of Liberty's head.
Right. And you don't see that in the film.
It's because it doesn't happen in the film.
Right. So that was one of the things I remember seeing J.J. Abrams, who did Cloverfield, or who, you know, produced and kind of came up with that idea, give a talk at TED. And he was talking about how, you know, he thought that was a really great image for that poster. And he was kind of sad to go see Escape from New York. And in exploitative fashion, there's no Statue of Liberty head. Mm-hmm. So he decided to kind of do Cloverfield with that imagery. But where else have you seen Escape from New York stuff?
Well, the biggest one for me, and it's kind of retroactive because I saw, or I rather played through Escape from New York first.
Well, how did you do that? Is there an Escape from New York video game?
There may have been. I don't want to go back to that.
Sounds like
NES
a bad Sega Genesis nightmare.
Or Atari. Right. But,
oh, yeah, that
Metal Gear Solid with Solid Snake Plissken.
Right.
So getting into Metal Gear Solid 2, Sons of Liberty, really quick. It's weird because I played this before ever seeing the film, but there's Solid Snake kind of dies in the very beginning of the game. And then you play as this other character who runs into Solid Snake. The guy goes up to him. He's like, hey, wait a second. Aren't you? And Snake goes, call me Plissken. And you're like, okay.
So do you think the references start there? Do you think it was inspired from the beginning?
Oh, dude. Solid Snake is just Snake Plissken without the eye patch and with a tighter suit on.
You know, it's
actually fun. No, not even the tighter suit. No, just different color.
It's weird. He's like wearing an 80s suit, even though the games are pretty recent. It's a direct, you know, callback to that, which is weird because Metal Gear has also become really popular, but in its own right, you know?
Yeah.
Usually when you see something pull so directly from a previous cult.
Yeah, it managed to somehow dodge people ever finding that out.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
I think it's because it's two completely different audiences.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
the Escape from New York people aren't the people that play Metal Gear Solid.
Sure. Well, when you do something that really pulls from a previous work like that and it has a cult following, it usually fails because the cult audience rejects it.
Right.
You know? It doesn't have sort of the, I guess, the like counterculture magic that the original thing had for, you know, whatever reason it had that. So that's part of what I'm interested in looking at Escape from New York, is finding out what are the elements of this film that give it its cult appeal. And why
is that counterculture magic?
Yeah, and why people, you know, wouldn't reject that. I mean, the first thing that struck me seeing this is the cast.
The cast is awesome in this film. If you're going to pick actors from that era, well, actually, it's probably more from the 70s.
Right.
Because you have Kurt Russell as Snake Plissken, which, incredible.
Yeah, we'll talk about Snake
then
Plissken.
You,
who else
You have Donald Pleasance as the president.
So Donald Pleasance we know as Loomis
Loomis.
Halloween. In the first, what, six films, right?
Six films.
Yeah.
You have also Adrian Barbeau, who's hot. always.
All right. Hey, we haven't been able to reference that in a while, but where else would we know her from?
Oh, she was from such films as Carnival.
Okay.
I meant films, by the way.
Okay, that's fine.
Harry Dean Stanton, who plays Brain,
mm-hmm.
and Chef.
Yeah.
Is also in this film.
Isaac Hayes appears in this film.
As the Duke of New York.
Yeah, the Isaac Hayes role is one of the craziest in this film for me. You know, I know people latch on to Snake Plissken, but... Well, then you also have Lee Van Cleef from A Few Dollars More, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You know, did some of that spaghetti western stuff in, like, what's a total throwaway role, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's the antagonist, but sort of.
Time is the antagonist right. in this film.
Right. Well, you also have that great, 80s mechanism of the countdown time clock.
This in true Metal Gear fashion, if we want to go for some kind of weird retroactive callback,
sure.
Doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Yeah, no.
Because they throw this thing around where they implant Snake's, his jugular veins.
Right.
With...
toxin.
A pill that will explode them.
Time released, yeah, sure.
And maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm misunderstanding, maybe something got cut out of the film, but Mr. Van Cleef's character says they will explode 15 minutes before the time goes
right.
out, before the final,
yeah.
the final hour ends.
That's not really how that works, does it?
No, well, because you get down to like 2 minutes and you're like, what happened?
Yeah.
Right, isn't right. he dead? Yeah. And then he like comes, he climbs over the wall and he comes like running and he's like, oh, I'm so angry. And then they go like, with some like little x-ray handlebars on his neck and he's fine.
You've seen this film far more and far more recently than I have. You know, I watched it the one time for the show and I saw it like as a kid.
Yeah.
I'm following you on this. I don't think that, I'm pretty sure that's just a mistake,
yeah.
right? We'd have to go back and really look at it again. But yeah, I'm almost positive they say, you know, win the 15 minutes for the clock
yeah.
thing. But then there's also this weird thing where he like calls them before the clock runs out
yeah.
at the end. And so I don't know if that affects the time or what's going on there. But,
yeah, there's a few things like that that kind of don't make any sense.
Well, not making any goddamn sense is part of cult appeal,
yeah.
I think. You know, you have a couple things specifically like set dressing and this stuff that doesn't make any fucking sense. So first of all, there is the stuff that is kind of visionary from this, and that the whole idea of steampunk borrows a lot of the actual world of New York, the post-apocalyptic look. I think John Carpenter was kind of famous for starting that, you know, what things look like after the apocalypse
mm-hmm.
kind of thing, which
everybody's
is mostly
got goggles.
Right,
and straps.
Yeah, right.
Goggles
and
straps.
And I was going to say newspapers on the ground everywhere, a lot of crumbled up newspaper. Which I always found weird in post-apocalyptic stuff. I guess the idea is that, like, people are stealing the newspapers out of the machines. Is that how that works?
I think it's just everything's gone so rampantly that...
Well, at the risk of dissecting this a bit too much, which is something we love to do here on Double Feature, why are there newspapers in the future?
Let's examine the three, because there are only three possibilities
okay,
for this newspaper. One you already went through, which is that all the newspapers... of all of New York City have been stolen
okay.
and cast to the streets
right.
because they're outdated.
All right.
One is that... So
didn't
people,
you just say one? Two,
two
I believe is.
Two is that the scum of New York City invaded our office buildings
okay.
and threw all of our Xerox paper
right.
out the windows, creating a rainfall of white paper hell.
Also probable. What's the third?
Thirdly is that Central Park itself, which I don't even think... Oh, no, it is in Manhattan. We're good.
I don't know anything about New York.
Central Park itself, full of trees. These hooligans chop down every tree in Central Park, process the pulp into paper, and in complete disdain for our society, cast it to the concrete of a post-apocalyptic New York City.
All right, I'm going to have to go with the third, and I'll tell you why. Here's my problem with a city that's ravaged and newspaper clippings flying all over the ground. This is a prison colony. Why would they deliver news to the prison colony? Someone has to make the newspaper, and I don't think it's the inmates
okay.
who are doing this, right?
Fair. All right.
The convicts are not running a
all
news
right,
press.
So that one's cast out. What about number two?
Number
the
two
Xerox
is
the Xerox paper.
Yeah, but that would still require... Here's what I'm
stairs.
Thinking is...
That would require stairs.
No, although that's a problem, too. The problem with that is that you're going to run out. I mean, how long has... You know, we're like toward the end of World War III here. So I would imagine this prison colony's been around for a while, right? This maximum state island. How long have they, like, Is that the same newspaper from like 10 years ago?
Just floating around on the ground? Also, I would have accepted this is in the future and we will be paperless by then.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I didn't expect them to know that in the 80s.
Another thing about Escape from New York that's that's probably one of the weirder things. While we're picking on the things that don't really make sense.
Hey, people tune into the show because they want to hear about newspaper distribution as seen in the 1980s about a post-apocalyptic film from the future, right?
The other thing that doesn't make a whole lot of sense is that instead of just demolishing bridges, they mine them.
Right. Right, yeah. Why wouldn't you just knock out the bridges
if you were... I mean, granted, it makes for one of the cooler scenes of the film.
Sure.
Going back to the cast, Ernest Borgnine also plays Cabby.
Right, good job.
Dies on the bridge. That's his role. Right. But
that's another one of the components of this, though, is these deaths, which almost everybody dies in this film. They die with little to no fanfare.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, in being the this is sort of like the anti-action movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's an action movie that's built without the usual staples that you almost want. There's a
clear problem with this film as far as the action goes. It's John Carpenter's single keyboard score.
Right. Well, the score, and I think the Foley to some effect, too. I mean,
yeah.
As you're watching this as an action film, it just doesn't feel like any of the punches are really connecting. You never feel, even the climax at the end with these mines and stuff, it just kind of feels like another scene where it's almost one of the, like, the down-tempo scenes in a normal action movie.
Right.
If John McClane were running through this minefield at the end of Die Hard... This would be like where you get up to like go make some popcorn before the film ends.
Right.
You know what I mean? I guess you don't make popcorn right before the film ends, but you get my point.
And if it were Rambo, he would be like running through like a gazelle.
Right.
And they would all be blowing up as he passed them.
Right.
For some reason.
But in Escape from New York, this is supposed to be the climax, and it does nothing in here feels climactic. Is that all the score and the sound you blame? Or
It's not. That's not the only thing I blame. The other thing that, and this is weird because I'm about to get technical on this bitch. John Carpenter uses really wide shots,
mm-hmm.
and it bothers me because I feel like it takes away from the intimacy and any...
There's no personality to it.
Well, and also it removes tension.
Sure.
Because you see everything.
Right.
Using wide shots for me always, it makes me less uncomfortable because I have a bigger scope of
what's
going on.
You talked about that
a
bit in Duel with the rear view mirror. You know, the less that it shows you, the more tense things are. And I mean, that's a larger metaphor for the camera. I think this is a really interesting film to look at because when you take out something like, you have the wide shots, for instance.
Yeah.
So you take out the personality there, you know, you don't have the usual intimate close up, whatever, but then you get the intimacy in something like how they make the city look or the different, you know, that's where the film's personality comes from.
Mostly the characters and the city as a character.
Well, and then you also have these characters that are drawn, almost as cartoons. You know, these kind of comic book-esque people. I mean, that's another one of the things I think is really iconic about Escape from New York is there's a lot of sort of, they're almost throwaway lines that lead you to believe, you know, we never really find out what caused the war or what phase the war's in or how this nuclear whatever thing is mm-hmm. going to like fix everything. These are all afterthoughts.
Right.
We're just focusing on Snake Plissken being in this weird...
Escaping from New York.
Right, that's exactly what it is. So we don't spend any... You know, that just leaves the viewer to wonder what is all of this other stuff that's been going on that we don't mm-hmm. know about. And I think it's the same kind of thing with the characters. Yeah, so maybe the wide shots is more a fault or whatever, but, you know, just go along with me on this one, right? So it's about less intimacy for the characters. You don't ever really find out the character's background. A lesser movie would tell you why Snake Plissken wears an eye patch.
Or why people think he's dead.
Right, exactly. You know, people just say that over and over, which is another great line from the film.
I think that's one of the funniest things.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. But you bring in personality in something like... And it's beyond just, you know, newspaper scattered across the street, right? There's a lot of nonsensical stuff in here that adds to the cult appeal. When I think John Carpenter and cult appeal... I think nonsense.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because I was kind of introduced with Big Trouble in Little China.
That's probably why.
But I mean, you have shit in here that, like, there's the car that Isaac Hayes is outfitted with.
He's
got chandeliers and the fucking disco ball thing. And, like, it doesn't make any fucking sense. And no one even thinks twice about it. You know what I mean?
No, it's just what
like
happens.
Snake Plissken, as an outsider, we could be doing the Big Trouble in Little China thing, which John Carpenter clearly knows how to do. He could introduce an outsider who goes, what the fuck is this guy driving? But instead, everything is treated as totally normal.
Well,
it's
all
fine.
Because Snake Plissken doesn't care.
Yeah, well, that's really
what it is. That's the glory of his character, right. is Snake Plissken, like, really, when it comes down to it, is only out for himself.
Right.
Like, he'll help other people if it doesn't get in the way of, like, his sandwich.
His time clock sandwich.
Yeah. Like, if there's anything going on where Snake Plissken has something to lose, he's not going to bother. And that's why the ending is so cool, because you run into this scenario where Snake goes to the president and he kind of goes, some people died out there today. I want to know how you feel about that. And the president's just like, oh, yeah, that was really sad. I got to go.
Yeah, right.
I felt like it goes without saying that Snake was kind of going to be like, well, if the president actually felt bad, he was going to give him the real tape.
Yeah, maybe.
But instead, the president was like, yeah, no, that sucks or something. Listen, I'm going to book here.
Yeah, right.
Could be back in like 30.
Thanks for saving me. Peace out. Yeah, well, it's part of that, going back to that weird Watergate connection. Yeah. It's that cynicism about the president. But yeah, I never really understood why at the end Snake Plissken is just like, fuck you, we're going to continue World War III. Because, well, you're right, I guess. I guess it's because he's so invested in himself, he doesn't really care.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's World War III for him, I guess, doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
Wouldn't you think that he would be invested in stopping World War
III? Well, you'd think that, but like at the same time, the president's not so much either, apparently.
You don't think so?
Well, no. I mean, think of it as a random sampling of the global scale. Mm-hmm. Snake goes, how do you feel about those people that aren't you dying?
Right.
To protect you.
Right.
President's like, oh, yeah, that was sad.
Yeah, okay.
And now,
so you're saying he's not really invested in the fate of...
He's not trying to save lives. He's trying to be the best president.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest, baddest, most Donald Pleasant world leader.
Right. He's trying to instill some kind of, like, legacy for himself.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why he's starting World War III. Yeah. I think what's more likely is that John Carpenter doesn't know why anyone would stop or...
I think that's that Snake probably has, like, a weird thing where he really just likes to pull the tape out of cassettes and, like, wrap it around his hand and pretend he's fighting bad guys.
You know who could have really used an eye patch, though, was Bill Maher.
Yeah.
We saw Religious. I want to tell you really quick about my theater-going experience on this.
This was something... I was supposed to go, and I bailed on that.
Well, you were watching... what was that thing?
What was I watching?
Christmas on Mars, right?
Oh, yeah. I had to go see Christmas on Mars. That's what happened. Yeah, okay. I don't apologize.
Oh, okay.
Revoke my apology.
All right, that's
better. My film had way more vaginas than yours.
Probably true. So, I mean, I went to see this in this little theater in Chicago. And I don't want this to come off the wrong way, but it was ridiculously cool sitting in this theater, and it wasn't a lot of people. It was probably us and maybe, you know, 10 or 20 other people. And just knowing that everybody in the theater was a fucking atheist. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, we all went to watch this movie, and clearly, especially with the reputation of Bill Maher, I don't think a single religious person, more religious people watch Richard Dawkins documentaries. Mm-hmm. And I mean that literally, not as like a gag, but really, right. I think that's true. Than a Bill Maher piece, because Bill Maher's kind of known for his cynicism. I mean, maybe that's the theme of the show today, is cynicism.
Yeah.
But he kind of tries to turn that into a positive thing. I mean, be more cynical, right? That's like his thing. I don't want to really get into Bill Maher because that would be an entire show in itself. But I think Bill Maher can get a little smug. And I think especially people who disagree with him would, you know, you get a mixed bag with that guy because he kind of purports to be a libertarian, but also he's a board member of PETA, which is a crazy organization.
Yeah. Also, he was a stand-up comedian.
Right.
And that can't be thrown out in a scenario where you're making or you're supposed to be making a documentary.
Right. And I think we'll see a lot of that come up here. But just going to see this in this theater and knowing that no one else religious really went to see this, this was all just a bunch of people who have no God. They're totally secular people. They got together and they just watched this film and they're all kind of having fun with it because above anything else, I think it's kind of supposed to be a comedy.
That's all you can do. Like, I feel like it'd be dangerous to take it for more than that.
Sure, sure. And so that experience with that whole group, we walked out of the theater and we were kind of just high on this feeling that, wow, that was really kind of cool that everybody just had that connection there. But when you and I watch this, we watch this from a very diagnostic perspective. Mm-hmm. We're like, all right, documentary, kind of get into this. And we figured this would be, you know, we haven't had a good bout of Jesus bashing on this show for quite some time. But after watching this documentary, I feel like there's a lot more pressing issues than how funny is that Jesus guy.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So this is a film about religion, I guess. I'd say it's about God, but it's about religion as a whole. The idea and where this fucking weird, awful marketing word that no one can pronounce came from. Religious, and this is how you remember it, is simply an amalgam of religious and ridiculous. And that is kind of Bill Maher's point with the film. And it's something that was directed by Larry Charles, who did Borat, and I'm sure that'll come up too. But this film starts off kind of giving its premise, and it almost plays like, I don't know if you remember the Spider-Man movies, the ones Sam Raimi did, and they have...
Spider-Man.
Of course you remember the Spider-Man movies, but, you know, the Spider-Man movies started this great thing with comic book movies where they told you what happened in the last film using the title sequence of the new film. So Spider-Man 2 had a little kind of animated, or I don't remember if it's animated, but it retells the events of Spider-Man 1 for the five people in the audience who haven't seen it. The title sequence of Religious is basically like, if you're an alien to this planet and you are not aware that religion is fucking ridiculous, here's what it looks like. And so we go through, you know, bullshit that the Pope said and people spouting off gibberish, mostly like televangelism. It's a lot of people on TV like telling you to send them money and purporting to like heal you and a bunch of shit that like, look, if you've listened to this show for a while, you know, Michael and I are both atheists and we don't believe in the nonsense, the woo, as James Randi would call it. And so, yeah, we kind of side with the film on, you know, on that angle. Yeah, when televangelists get up and they say, you know what, throw your medication on stage because I'm going to heal you. You don't need medicine anymore. That shit is fucking, not only is it ridiculous, but it's just appalling. Yeah. I think that is like one of the fucking worst crimes a person on TV, looking at you, Oprah.
I was looking at Jenny McCarthy.
That's a fine direction to look. And you know, the other thing this film tries to tell you is that no one really knows what's going on in the Bible. And I think to some degree, to a large degree, that's true. So maybe Bill Maher's point with this is just to say, all right, you know what? People aren't critically looking at religion. I'm going to show them how fucking ridiculous it is. And then maybe they'll kind of wake up and, you know, look at it there. As far as an argument approach, before we, for the first time ever, get into the mechanics of a documentary rather than the ideas of a documentary, are there any new arguments being presented here, or any that you think are particularly powerful?
The only argument that I really like would ever take away from this film is the one, and the delivery kind of made me a little nauseous.
Right.
But the part where Bill Maher basically goes, "You can't say you know there's a God. You don't know that."
Right.
Like, I'm not saying that I know there isn't one.
Right.
But in the same regard. You don't know there is.
Well, and that's part of, you know, his big pitch at the beginning is that he's out here promoting doubt. You know, he doesn't know. He says that's his big thing. Although if you've watched any of his material, it's hard with comedians because, you know, a lot of it's for jokes. And you never know, like, when you're grabbing at what's real and you're just grabbing at jokes, which I think is the big thing that kind of, when you take a critical look at this documentary, sort of rubs me the wrong way. But he says he's out promoting doubt. Whether that's been true before or not, or whether that was ever his big thing, I think that's, you know, that's his big thing for right now. So I'm willing to take him at face value for that. I find some of the more compelling things here to be the thing about the Ten Commandments being law. It's not an idea that I kind of wish it was expanded on more, but whatever. I'm not the editor of this film.
It wouldn't be funny expanded on more.
That's probably the issue here. But there's this kind of idea that we are founded as a Christian nation and the forefathers were Christians and our laws are all, there's not one law we have that's based on the Ten Commandments. Right. When I lived in Buena Park, you couldn't park on the street. I challenge you to tell me which commandment that's against.
Mm-hmm.
He hits on this and there's basically just two. It's don't kill and don't steal. And those are probably the only two commandments that really mean anything. The rest are about jealous gods and weird quirks of the faith. And then beyond that, I mean, that's one thing to look at and kind of go, okay, there's no law that really comes from the Ten Commandments that we couldn't have figured out fucking otherwise. Also, these are the 10 fucking rules handed down from God. Why aren't they more important? You know, there's nothing about like raping in there. In fact, the Bible is really evangelizing rape, especially in situations where it's beneficial to you.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, and I think more rooted, I guess less rooted in theology and more in fact, is this idea that the founding fathers were religious. Because they weren't. They were deists. Which, like, people will argue with me, but deists were the atheists of that time.
Yeah.
I don't want to go around claiming the forefathers were atheists just because atheism wasn't like an out movement at the time. You know, that's kind of something I believe, but I mean, fact-based, let's call them what they were. They said they were deists, so they're deists. And I think one of the most powerful things he presents in the whole documentary is just going through quotes of the founding fathers and showing you that, yeah, these don't really sound like ideas that were coming from religious people. Thomas Jefferson, above all, right? You know, who did?
Well, I've heard Thomas Jefferson is perfect for all right. anything like that.
Right. Thomas Jefferson did, you know, the Jefferson Bible, which was just the New Testament with all the religious shit cut out. Basically, it didn't have any, you know, anything that wasn't rooted in fact. It was the teachings of Christ.
It was, yeah, it was the
all
was,
the miracles are cut out and all the claims of divinity.
The good intentions of the Bible or something like that.
Which, if you read the Jefferson Bible, it's shorter than the...
It's considerably shorter.
Yeah, it certainly
Have you
is.
Seen it, like, in print? Oh, it's no, really small.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have... I've
it
only
it kind of seems
online.
Like a glove compartment book.
That's like a pocket Bible.
Yeah.
There's also this other thing, you know, he goes to talk to the Vatican's astronomer, which seems like a total oxymoron there.
The astronomer, isn't he the guy that says, like, the Vatican hires me to know before they know so that we can... He doesn't... And then that's where his quote kind of stops, but you kind of... There's an ellipsis there where he's thinking so that we can beat them and come up with reasons why they're wrong.
Yeah, maybe. He seems like a guy, you know, that whole situation over there struck me more as... I don't know. It just seems like bizarro world.
Yeah.
It's part of that cognitive dissonance thing where it's like, you know, your rules of your faith go directly against what you do, what you practice as, right. you know, your job or your hobby or whatever.
Like Donkey Kong and hot sauce.
Something Bill Maher doesn't really ask, you know, when this guy presents this idea about, you know, the greater facts of modern science not coming from the Bible. Why? Why are they not in the Bible? This is stuff that God's handing down to us. He thinks it's really important. And as we found out, you know, living practically for millennia, science turns out is really important. Mm-hmm. The biggest, you know, progressions, whether you're talking about, you know, modern transportation or modern biology, I mean, all of this stuff comes from science. So God couldn't give us any of that in the Bible.
No.
In fact, he gives us the opposite of that. He gives us all of the stuff that later we found out wasn't so true with science.
I'm starting to think he's not real.
But whatever, I mean, that's, you know, if you want to look at those arguments and how they're being presented in the film, it kind of reminds me of when he's talking to the so-called ex-Jew about the big fish story, you know, which I always thought was funny, too, that everyone goes, well, it's not a whale, it's a big fish. Like, yeah. That fucking changes the, you know, claims there.
Yeah.
But it's like talking to a brick wall. I mean, you know, if you, not to invoke James Randi again.
That nobody built.
Michael Shermer will tell you the same thing, that if you are truly faithful, I mean, we can't touch you. You know, the people, you're not converting those people. You're not appealing to their logic. You're not whatever.
Well, it's like the beginning of the Vatican episode of Bullshit. Have you seen that yet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where Penn Jillette kind of has an aside and he goes, okay, well, if you're one of these people that actually believes that the Pope is infallible,
right.
and anything he does is sent down from God, then mm-hmm. we're not going to be able to change your mind.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
already fucked up, and like we can't do anything sure. about that, and you're just gonna have to deal. But if for any reason you have any sense of doubt that the Pope is like not a perfect being, then
you're
the Vatican
evidence,
is bullshit.
Right? Yeah. Sure. Well, and in and of itself kind of makes you go, okay, well, am I going to be, which of these two people am I going to be? Am I going to be the kind of person who looks at evidence critically, or am I going to just be like, well, no, the Pope is infallible and I'm, you know, going
he
to plug my ears as
satellite hat to Jesus.
So part of the reason that, you know, I don't even really feel like discussing the arguments in this is that Bill Maher seems to be trying to appeal to the people with their fingers in their ears.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, he's going to this, this trucker's chapel. And you're seeing, and I think he does I will totally give him credit for this. I think he does a really good job of not arguing with these people mm-hmm. on the spot.
Yeah, he's really inoffensive.
He really is, yeah. You know, like, I expected this to be far more gags, far more in your face. And maybe some of that stuff, you know, was edited out of the final cut of this. But it does seem like he went into it going, I'm going to ask these people questions. I'm going to see if I can get them to question their own ideas. But when they, you know, people say the most ludicrous shit to him in this, and he doesn't really even fire back with, come on, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially with the trucker's chapel. Also, interesting thing to note about that is one of the guys there purports that he was a Satanist.
Mm-hmm.
Previously on the show, I have asked if anyone has really been a Satanist ever, if that even exists, because I have my doubts that Satanism is a real thing that people do. Do you buy what this guy's selling, that he used to have fistfuls of dollars in his pockets and women every night?
The thing about that is, it strikes me as that guy was just living up the party life.
All right, so I don't need to revoke my previous skepticism.
No, I feel like he was just living up a very that type of lifestyle and then converted to Christianity, and some stupid priest along the way was like, you were living the ways of Satan. And he was like, I was a Satanist.
I was a satanic preacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that exact same feeling. Still interested, though, if you know any real Satanists, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. All right, so the thing that there really is to talk about here is this mix of Bill Maher and Larry Charles, which presents some tactics that I'm really uncomfortable with as a documentary. You know, when they did this thing, they called it a spiritual journey. They didn't tell people it was called Religious. They never told people that Bill Maher was involved. And they basically deceived people to get, you know, these interviews and stuff. We've rallied against that before, specifically with Michael Moore, and we'll do it again with Michael Moore because people apparently still aren't hearing the words that we're saying. But these sound like the tactics we're going to see next week in Expelled. They don't sound like something that, you know, we're used to the bullshit approach.
Yeah.
You go in with your hat that says Penn and Teller's bullshit on it, and you tell people we're from Penn and Teller's bullshit, they're, you know, two atheists and they want to interview you about God. And people, because they want to sell their books and they, you know, they really believe their message, they go, all right, you know, I'll go into the so-called lion's den. And it just strikes me as weird that Bill Maher, who does, you know, real time with Bill Maher every week, people go in, and the term lion's den is almost used exclusively for that show, for people who, you know, are on the right wing or don't fit into his demographic, coming in and being like, you know what, I'm going to come out here and I'm going to present my ideas. But he's not doing that here. I mean, why not? Why not go in and be like, look, this is Bill Maher's religious documentary. He doesn't agree with you, but we'd really like to hear your side of it.
You know, because
that's the fair thing to do, right?
This, I think the biggest issue with this documentary versus a lot of what we've gone through is this documentary has a star.
Right.
Like, it's starring Bill Maher, and sure, the star has to be winning. He's got to have the upper hand.
Right.
He's got to have the jokes.
Well, like, that's part of what it
you,
is,
if
too.
You introduce somebody more charismatic than him, or somebody that's better prepared,
right,
you're going to run into issues where maybe he's going to like get overshadowed, and that'll kind of combat the whole purpose of the film anyway.
Well, so, I think that's kind of the Larry Charles angle. You know, I haven't seen Bruno yet, because Borat kind of, again, rubbed me the wrong way.
Me too, but I liked Bruno.
All right, well, Borat was the kind of thing I could look at and go, you know, yeah, he's using deceptive tactics to get these interviews and stuff, and it's like sabotage stuff, right? But it's for gags. It's not really, you know, I like Borat up until the point where people try to use it as a real commentary of human nature. I don't like when people try to go, wow, he's exposing all those rednecks. It's like, if you go in somewhere and you try to, I think there is this natural human tendency to try and agree with, you know, other people. And so when you go in somewhere and you go, you know, man, all of this ethnicity is stupid, right? You will find people who agree with you because they're actually kind of nice people and they're just agreeable and they're not really thinking about what they're talking about. So maybe those tactics are okay for something like Borat, which is exclusively about humor. Mm-hmm. But now where you have Larry Charles doing this documentary, you have him using the same kind of like sabotage, sneak attack tactics to make it. And I don't feel like that's fair. I don't know. Where do you come down on that?
It's, you know, that's never a good idea.
Right.
Like, you're always better off, and you're going to make a better documentary if everybody's aware of what's going on.
Sure.
Because that just means you have to be that much more prepared. Like,
right.
It's easy to make
you get to the truth faster.
It's easy to make a documentary that proves your point if you're the only one that knows the point you're making.
Sure, sure.
Like, if I were to come in here and be like, I'm making a documentary, it's about God, and we were to have a conversation about God, you and me, and then, like, I were to go home and put out a documentary on why forks are really cool,
right?
I would win.
Yeah.
Because I would have said weird things about forks, and you'd been like, yeah,
sure.
Okay.
Well, and then anyway, to go back to the bullshit idea and something I like so much about that show, if you haven't seen Penn and Teller's Bullshit, you owe it to yourself to just get every fucking season of that thing, because it's great. But they go on there, and the show is about ideas. The show is not about people and who's like, who can get the best gotcha moment and sabotage and whatever. The show is about our ideas are clearly right. We believe that they're right. And so we're going to bring on the opposition. We're going to kind of still make it funny. And, you know, they mm-hmm. do the same thing. They make funny documentary, you know, episodes. But they're like, all right, here's their fair chance, and now we're going to tell you why that's fucking stupid.
Right.
Here, Bill Maher's not really giving people their fair chance. The angle that I kind of come at and wonder if that's more okay, I don't think it's okay. I'm just going to show my hand on that right now. But I'm curious, do you think if his goal is to make something, if funny comes first, as has always been the case for Bill Maher, with his stand-up and even with his political show, which, you know, can get heady at times, but can also be watered down by really bad joke segments in the middle, is it okay to do this if you're more going for laughs? I mean, does the laugh trump
Unfortunately, like when you're doing something that's labeled documentary,
right,
you can't really put anything before the documentation.
Right.
Even if you're making a documentary going, oh, this is just for people who already agree with me, mm-hmm. whatever, like it's dangerous because you're not spitting fact the
right.
whole time.
Right, right. And then, you know, when your documentary is thrown into the arena of fact, it doesn't hold up as well because you kind of go for gags here and there. I mean, they're trying to pull a laugh anywhere they can in this.
Right.
Even the sound mix is like there's subdued sound effects in the back of people's stuff. I mean, that's another thing that makes me uncomfortable because, you know, I don't want to pull apart this entire thing and be like, it's not the Michael Moore thing. Michael Moore is really purporting to be about fact with a little bit of funny thrown in, and there's just like no fact in there. It's cut up and it's presented to you out of context, and it uses a lot of deceptive tactics. Religious only does that where it serves the jokes. I don't feel like it's really being deceptive unless it thinks it can be funny. But when you're going for, you know, when you're adding in sound effects to some of these scenes, they come off, I mean, if you didn't kind of know Foley stuff and know what to look for, you would think situations are playing out differently than they actually right. are, and you would get a different presentation of, you know, fact
mm-hmm.
of how the events actually transpired. And I don't think that's okay to do.
No, it's
even
not.
If you're going for gags. Part of his idea here is to say religion is ridiculous, and so he's trying to put together an hour and a half, you know, pretty lighthearted thing just to show people, just to kind of make people wake up and go, oh, you know what? A lot of these things are ridiculous. It's the same thing he does in his stand-up is rather than, you know, presenting facts, he's kind of just poking fun at the different pieces of religion and going, come on, guys, really just look at this. He feels like the problem with religion is that people aren't just taking a second to pause, step back, and just look at the situation they're in and be like, yeah, this is fucking ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, I should maybe think twice about this. Any merit to that, though, I feel like is totally lost at the ending of this film.
The ending of this film drove me nuts, and it just made me, like, really uncomfortable, because the whole time it's like, oh, this is funny, and okay, whatever. Like, I'm at least enjoying Bill Maher.
Right.
And then it ends, like, I don't really remember the sequence of events that leads to this point. It doesn't really...
There is no leading.
Yeah, it doesn't
it
really matter.
It just appears out of nowhere.
Suddenly, it's just a montage of people praying and nuclear explosions.
Sure.
And, I mean, granted, I don't think religion's good, but I don't think that makes any sense.
Right, we're not about to do the, like, the enemy of my enemy is my yeah. friend thing here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, neither of us would ever encourage someone to find religion. We think religion is... I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like it does more harm than good.
Yeah.
And so generally when I see something that tends to be atheistic or, you know, against religion, I kind of gravitate towards it and go, okay, what is this? What are the ideas they're presenting here? You know, I mean, we've both read the Hitchens stuff, the Dawkins mm-hmm. stuff. We're interested in that. But just because something is against religion doesn't mean I'm automatically going to side with it.
Right.
But here's another part of the thing is I went to it scared that it was going to be cynical and that it was going to make me uncomfortable, and it did less of that than I thought it was, so I was originally kind of a big fan of this. But upon an independent kind of examination of this, I think, especially when you bring in a post-apocalyptic sort of ending like that, you know, here's how we got to escape from New York, World War III, I feel like you leave the realm of documentary too far behind, and you can't, you know... I'd feel like that guise of documentary is no longer a fair thing to use as a vehicle for your film.
All right, so in the same fashion as Religious, we're going to start really fun and lighthearted and end on a big downer note.
Yeah, I guess. I guess that's what's going to happen.
So, yeah.
We have a website. It's doublefeatureshow.com and an email address, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. If you think that Religious was doing something fantastic, then write us an email. We have a ridiculous number of atheist listeners. People write us emails all the time about atheist stuff, which, you know, I think it's hip. But we would like to know, you know, defend this film because I want to like it, but it makes me really uncomfortable. And I'm totally open to the fact that maybe I'm just looking at this in the wrong light. You know, I'm curious what people think. Also, if you think you know more of the cult appeal of Escape from New York than we got to, and we're going to get to LA, so, mm-hmm. you know, don't write in with that shit yet, but, you know, write in and let us know about that. Next up, we're going to do another show that doesn't make any sense,
yeah.
and it's almost a double feature pairing to this show. What yeah. are we doing next time on the show?
Next time, we're going to be doing Escape from LA, John Carpenter's think they came out 8 or 10 years later than
Escape from New York. Escape from LA is 96. Yeah, and Escape from New York's 81, right?
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, 15 years.
Yeah, that's a long time.
15 years between Snake Plissken's first escape and now his second. We're also doing Expelled. That will be the second film next week.
Oh, right. I forgot about that. So, unfortunately, I think we're going to see a lot of the same shit in Expelled. You haven't seen this yet.
No.
Expelled is the Ben Stein creationism.
Ben Stein in little boy shorts.
Yeah. Ben Stein creationist documentary. Some people will call it intelligent design. There's literally no difference between the two except for the name. And the group of people who try to tell you that it's not about God, but that's exactly what it is. I had a little bit of a fear that doing these episodes kind of back to back like this, we would look like we're doing this stupid false dichotomy present both sides thing.
No, we're not doing that.
I think it's a little more interesting to kind of look at a documentary that most people will accept is awful and wrong and uses some of the exact same tactics as a documentary religious that people seem to like. So maybe we'll attack it from that angle. What we're certainly not going to do is here's the other side of the God argument, because that's fucking ridiculous.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.